You can go ahead and turn in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 46. Genesis chapter 46 is where we'll be picking up. And we'll just give a brief review of the book of Genesis as a whole, where we're at, so we have our place in the book as we normally do. And so after the creational prologue, Genesis is divided into 10 toledo, or generations heading, and we have the prologue, the origins of the universe, and then we have the first set of five headings, the origins of the nations, so five toledo, five generations headings that give the origins of the nations, and then we have five toledo that give the origins of Israel. And we're going to see there's a fascinating repetition of this pattern in Exodus that's really quite fascinating, and I'm excited to get to that here in a few weeks. But of the five toledot that deal with the origins of Israel, you have Terah, and that tells the story of Abraham. Abraham is Terah's son. And then you have Ishmael, and Ishmael is the Passover line. And then you have Isaac, and then you have Esau, and Esau is the Passover line as well. And then you have the generations of Jacob, and of course, at that point, there's no Passover line because the nation of Israel has been assembled, and so all of the 12 patriarchs are in that line of promise, and that is very significant, and we'll get to some of that when we get into the genealogy here just in a few minutes. And so the 10th and final section is the generations of Jacob, and that takes us from Genesis 37 in verse 2 through the end of chapter 50. And so in Genesis 37, you have division in the family. All of the brothers are together, but they are divided and they are fighting and they are spinning off into different directions and they sell Joseph into slavery. Then in chapter 38, you have Judah apart from his brothers. So Judah goes away from his brothers and has some misadventures of his own. And then in chapter 39 through 41, you have Joseph apart from his brothers. And then in chapters 42 through 47, which is the section that we are in now, you have three journeys down to Egypt. So you have the coming back together again of the family. So chapter 42 is the first journey. And then chapters 43 through 45 is the second journey, which includes Benjamin. And then chapters 46 through 47, which is the section we are in now, is the third journey that includes the whole family and brings them down to Egypt. And so then, chapters 48 through 50 is the passing of Jacob and Joseph, and that's the final section that is coming up next. And so chapters 46 through 47 relate the third journey to Egypt. And like the first two journeys, this third journey can also be divided into seven basic scenes. So scene one is God appears to Jacob. That's in 46, 1 through 4. And we dealt with this particular scene two weeks ago, the last time we were in Genesis. Scene two, you have Jacob's journey down to Egypt. Scene three, Joseph meets Jacob. Scene four, Joseph's brothers meet with Pharaoh. Scene five, Jacob meets with Pharaoh. Scene six, Joseph cares for his family and for Egypt. And then Jacob prepares to die in scene seven. And there are a number of differences between this third journey and the two that preceded it. All three journeys start with the decision by Jacob. They all have a midpoint that deals with some form of confinement in the land of Egypt. And they all conclude with Jacob talking about his death. So they all begin with Jacob talking about a trip down to Egypt. They all focus on confinement in the land of Egypt, and they all end with Jacob talking about his death. And so those are the overlaps, and that is between all three journeys, even though the individual stories are very different. And so the last time that we were in Genesis, a few weeks ago, we finished the second journey and made it through the first scene of the third journey. And so we pick up the story in chapter 46 and verse 5. And Jacob rose up from Beersheba, and we talked about the significance of Beersheba the last time, and the sons of Israel carried Jacob, their father, and their little ones, and their wives, in the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. And they took their cattle and their goods, which they had gotten in the land of Canaan, and came into Egypt, Jacob and all his seed with him, his sons and his sons' sons with him, his daughters and his sons' daughters, and all his seed brought he with him into Egypt. It's really striking. You have the sons of Israel carried Jacob, their father. And remember, we talked about the different emphasis of this name Israel and the name Jacob. And to see the two of them here in this one sentence, it just strikingly confirms exactly the emphasis we've been pointing out all along. So you have the sons of Israel. So this is Israel as the father of an entire nation. So Israel's sons carry their old and helpless father and pick him up and put him in the wagon. And of course, as the object of being carried, using the name Jacob is particularly appropriate. And so you just have that neat interchange, even in a single sentence. And it gives the lie to those skeptical scholars who try to piece the text, you know, chop the text up into these tiny little pieces and use the variations in vocabulary as a justification for doing so. It's the unity and the way everything ties together is amazing. And all his seed, mentioned this earlier, all his children, he brought with him into Egypt. A quote from a commentator: Jacob has no Ishmael as Abraham had, and no Esau as Isaac had. Jacob's decidedly dysfunctional family is on the verge of coming together again in genuine community. And this is why the reuniting of the family was so very important, because the family is going to be brought to completion. There's not going to be any more skipped over lines in the nation of Israel. And so it was very important that Judah not wander off on his own, that his adventures be brought to a conclusion, that Joseph not disappear and be separated from the family, but that all of them would come together. And this is what drives the story of Genesis. Is God made a promise in Genesis 3:15 that there would be a seed of the woman who would destroy the seed of the serpent. And as you go through the story of Genesis, you see every conceivable obstacle being raised as the serpent is warring against the seed of the woman to keep God's promises from being fulfilled. And yet God's promises remain right on track through all of that. And now we come to the genealogy, and it may seem like this is boring and dry, but actually, there's so many fascinating things going on in the genealogy. So I'm not going to even cover a fraction of what's here, but I need to give you at least a little bit of a sense of what's being included in the text, because this may seem to us like a genealogy, who wants to hear about all of that, but an incredible amount of care was given to the composition of this genealogy. And we're just going to scratch the surface. So it begins in verses 8 through 15 with the descendants that came through Leah. So Leah's sons were Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. So she had six sons and Dinah, her daughter, that are mentioned here. So six sons and one daughter that we know about. So of the 12 tribes of Israel, fully half of them were sons of Leah. So let's read verses 8 through 15. And these are the names of the children of Israel which came into Egypt: Jacob and his sons, Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, and the sons of Reuben, Hanok and Phallu and Hezron and Carmi. And so you have Reuben and Reuben's sons, and the sons of Simeon, Jemuel and Jamin and Ohad and Jachin and Zohar and Shaul the son of a Canaanitish woman. And then you have the sons of Levi, Gershon and Kohath and Merari, and the sons of Judah, Ur and Onan and Shelah, and Pharez and Zerah, but Ur and Onan died in the land of Canaan. And the sons of Pharez were Hezron and Hamul, and the sons of Issachar, Tola and Phuva, and Job and Shimron, and the sons of Zebulun, Sarad and Elon, and Jalil. These be the sons of Leah, which he bare unto Jacob in Padan Aram, with his daughter Dinah. All the souls of his sons and his daughters were 33. Now, these are the names. This is actually how the book of Exodus starts. In fact, when we get to Exodus, we'll talk about this in more detail. The name of Exodus in Hebrew is "These are the names," and it's exactly this line. So this is actually, in Hebrew, the title of the book of Exodus that it's most commonly known by. And so there's a strong tie-in to what we're about to find in Exodus. And so these are the names of the children of Israel, which came into Egypt, Jacob and his sons. And the way this is arranged, Jacob is actually going to be included in the total. So the children of Israel, though we don't really think this way, the children of Israel includes Jacob himself. And that will be significant here in a moment. You have the sons of Perez. So Perez is the son of Judah. So this is skipping down to verse 12. So if you remember, Judah has three sons. He has Onan, and Shelah. And and Onan die because they're wicked against the Lord. And Judah is supposed to give Shelah to Tamar. Well, he doesn't do that. And so then Judah has two sons, twins, in fact. He has Perez and Zerah by Tamar. So Perez and Zerah, even though they're Judah's sons, are actually, because he has them with his daughter-in-law, they would be the same age as his grandsons. So these would be the same age as Jacob's great grandchildren. And so it's very unlikely that Perez would have actually had sons. It's impossible for Perez to have had sons because Perez is like a newborn baby when they come down to Egypt. And so Hezron and Hamul wouldn't have been born yet at the time of this genealogy, but they are mentioned to make up for Judah's two sons that died. So because and Onan died in the land of Canaan, they're not counted in the total, but Perez's two sons, Hezron and Hamul, are added. And in the sense, as in we find in the book of Hebrews, and as I may so say, Levi also, who received its tithes, paid tithes in Abraham, for he was yet in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. So Perez's sons wouldn't have been born yet, but they're counted as though they're still in the loins of Perez. Does anyone know what the big deal about Perez is? I know some of you do. Perez, where's that name mentioned? Nathan Axtell, he is Boaz's dad. Well, he's not Boaz's dad, but that's the connection. Ruth 4:18, now these are the generations of Perez. Perez begat Hezron, and Hezron begat Ram, and Ram begat Amminadab, and Amminadab begat Nashon, and Nashon begat Salmon, and Salmon begat Boaz, and Boaz begat Obed, and Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David. And so you have these extra generations given to Perez here, and it's significant because Perez is the one who's ultimately going to be the father of David, and in the end, the father of Christ. And even though the story of Perez's birth is a strange and twisted one, the Lord works through that to bring the Savior into the world. And so finally, we come to the end, and we get to the names totaling 30 and 3. That's in verse 15. So in order to arrive at 33, Jacob is included, as is Dinah. And Onan are not included. And there are a number of patterns within this that's just crazy, but we're not going to go into all of them. I'm only going to pick just some of the most interesting of the details. But it's interesting that Jacob is included in with Leah's count and would also be buried along with her. So when we get to Genesis 49, we'll find, "And he charged them and said unto them, I am to be gathered unto my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite for possession of a burying place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah. And there I buried Leah." So even though Leah was the wife that was hated, and Leah was the wife that no matter what she did, Jacob didn't ever seem to care about her. In the end, Jacob is included in the count of Leah, not any of his other wives, and Jacob ends up being buried with Leah. Though Leah was the hated wife, God eventually did vindicate her in his own time and in his own way. Any questions or comments about the descendants of Leah before we move forward through the genealogy? I'll go once, twice, three times. Okay, I don't see anyone raising their hand. And the sons of Gad. So now we went through Leah. So Leah was Jacob's first wife. And then we have the descendants of Zilpah. And Zilpah is the concubine of, so Zilpah was the servant of Leah. And Leah, when she stopped bearing children, she gave Zilpah to Jacob as well. And Zilpah's two sons were Gad and Asher. And we have the genealogy of Gad and Asher. And the sons of Gad, in verse 16, were Ziphion and Haggai and Shuni and Ezbon and Eri and Eridi and Areli. And the sons of Asher were Jimnah and Ishua and Isui and Beriah and Sarah, their sister. And the sons of Beriah, Heber and Malkiel. These are the sons of Zilpah, whom Laban gave to Leah, his daughter. And these she bare unto Jacob, even 16 souls. So just to give a hint of the complexity in the patterns that are here, Gad is the seventh of the sons. So Gad is Zilpah's first son. She's the seventh son listed. And the numerical value of the letters in his name is seven. And he has seven listed descendants. That's not a coincidence. Someone is having a lot of fun with this list. And there are literally dozens of things like this going on in this list. It is like a three-dimensional crossword of numerical significances that you can go this way, you can go this way, you can go sideways, and it's just, it gets almost mind-boggling how many different patterns you have here. But, you know, you don't get that sort of, you don't get things to add up that way by accident. And you have that Laban gave to Leah his daughter. And the mention of Laban brings us back to the confusing and conflict-ridden time when Jacob's sons were being born. If you remember back to Genesis 30 through 32, when Jacob's sons are being born, it seemed like everything was completely out of control. And Jacob's wives are fighting and warring with one another, and just everything is falling apart. And we're reminded of that by this mention of Laban. And yet, when it seemed like everything was out of control, it was then that God was putting together the incredibly complex and intricate patterns that we see here. And so the total for Zilpah is 16. And when Jacob is excluded, so remember we had 33 for Leah, and we said that Jacob was included in that total. So when Jacob is excluded, you have 32 for Leah, and Leah's handmaid, Zilpah, has 16, which is exactly half of Leah's total. Now, this might seem like a coincidence, except that the exact same thing happens with Rachel and Bilhah. Rachel has 14, and Bilhah has 7. And if you turn it around the other way, Leah and Rachel together are 46, and Zilpah and Bilhah are 23. And so the exact number of, so each wife has twice as many descendants as her handmaiden, and the two wives together have twice as many descendants as the two handmaidens together. And this is not a coincidence because there's only one granddaughter mentioned. So you have Sarah, their sister. It is unfathomable and unthinkable that Jacob only had one granddaughter among all of these sons and daughters. What this tells us is that names are being included and not mentioned in order to arrive at these particular totals. So this isn't just a happenstance that it just happened to work out this way. There's a particular pattern that's being set up to make a particular point. So like other peculiarities, this is in service to the numerical patterning in the text. And if this seems unusual to us and we're like, that's just weird, why would you put so much time and effort into this, we need to remember that we don't get to go to scripture and say, here's what's relevant, here's what's important, here's what's interesting, but rather we need to go to scripture and find out, well, what did the writers, what did the Spirit inspire the writers to include? You know, what did what did God think was interesting? And allow that to inform what we think may be relevant. And so you have the descendants of Leah, you have the descendants of Zilpah, and now we come to the descendants of Rachel. Joseph and Benjamin are her two sons. So starting in verse 19, the sons of Rachel, Jacob's wife, Joseph and Benjamin, and unto Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim, which Asenath, the daughter of Potiphar, priest of On, bare unto him. And the sons of Benjamin were Bela and Beker and Ashbel, Gera and Naaman and Ehi and Rosh, Mupim and Hupim and Ard. And the sons, these are the sons of Rachel, which were born to Jacob. All the souls were 14. Then you have the descendants of Bilhah, Dan and Naphtali. And the sons of Dan, Hushim, and the sons of Naphtali, Jaziel and Guni and Jezer and Shillem. These are the sons of Bilhah, which Laban gave unto Rachel his daughter, and she bare these unto Jacob. All the souls were 7. And so once again, you have Rachel's total as 14, and then Bilhah, who was Rachel's maid, who was given to Jacob, her descendants were exactly half of Rachel's. In verse 26, we find the conclusion. All the souls that came with Jacob into Egypt, which came out of his loins, besides Jacob's sons' wives, all the souls were 66, or 66. And the sons of Joseph, which were born to him in Egypt, were 2 souls. All the souls of the house of Jacob, which came into Egypt, were 70. So we have 2 summary totals here. So here's how the 66 comes into play. So omitting from the previous total, you have Jacob. So you have all the souls that came with Jacob into Egypt, which came out of his loins. So you have 2 modifiers, those that Jacob actually fathered and those who traveled to Egypt with him. And so Jacob didn't father himself, so you can scratch Jacob from the total of 70. And Joseph and his 2 sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, were already in Egypt, so they didn't come to Egypt with Jacob, so you can scratch those 3. So you take 70 minus 4, and you come up with 66. There are several, this has occasioned a lot of discussions, and there's some more complicated ways of calculating this, but this seems to me the simplest. It adds up, and I think it fits the data in the text. So I'll spare you the alternative theories and cut to what all of this means. All of the souls of the house of Jacob, which came into Egypt, were 70, or 70. And this brings us back to the table of the nations that is found in Genesis chapter 10. Not coincidentally, the table of the nations. So remember how Genesis is divided into the story of the nations, the origin of the nations in the first half of the book, and the origins of Israel in the second half of the book. Not coincidentally, as we get towards the end of the first half of the book, we find the table of the nations, 70 nations, in whom all the peoples of the earth are summed up. As we get to the end of the second half of the book that tells the origins of Israel, we find this very similar genealogy that tells the 70 souls from which the house of Jacob would be, the house of Israel would be built. And it's not a coincidence that you also find this in Exodus 1:5, this total number of 70. And this is just one hint among many that God had not forgotten his promise that the call of Abram would be the means of blessing the nations through his descendants. And in light of what follows in the book of Acts, it's also unlikely to be a coincidence that Jesus is said to send out 70 disciples as his representatives. Luke 10:1, after these things, the Lord appointed other 70 also and sent them 2 and 2 before his face into every city and place whither he himself would come. Therefore said he unto them, the harvest truly is great, but the laborers are few. Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he would send forth laborers into his harvest. And so I just should note that some translations have 72 in Luke 10, but that actually only underscores this because some manuscripts of the Greek Old Testament, which was used, so which old many Christian scribes would be familiar with, actually add 2 names in Genesis 10. So it only underscores the fact that they saw that as a connection. So I won't go into all the pros and cons there, but that doesn't remove that connection. But what you have is you have 70 nations in Genesis 10, summing up all the peoples of the earth, And then you have God focusing on the nation of Israel that is built upon these 70 souls. And then you have Jesus calling 70 disciples through whom the message that is going to be broadcast at Pentecost is going to undo the division of the nations. It's going to bring blessing to everyone. So it is to be spread. In either case, the point, so though the day of Pentecost was yet to come, Jesus was already hinting that his representatives are to go forth into all the nations to gather the new people of God in whom all the nations are being blessed through the person and work of Christ. So you have that connection that's far off in the future. But even already here in the text of Genesis, if you go back to Genesis 30 and you go back to the confusing mess of the birth of Jacob's children. And if you remember, you have Rachel and Leah are fighting each other tooth and claw, and it's a nasty, messy, grimy disaster. But when we were back in chapter 30, I pointed out that God is mentioned in this overall section exactly 7 times before the mandrakes, which is sort of the centerpiece of their fight, were brought in, and exactly 7 times afterward. And I said then that this hinted at the fact that God was in control. It was one of those little literary hints that the disaster, the way that things looked, was not the way that things were. And although Leah and Rachel did exactly what they wanted to do, and what they wanted to do was mostly bad, God continued working to fulfill his promises and accomplish his purposes. Behind the apparent randomness and obvious brokenness of the birth of Jacob's children, God was accomplishing his plan with astonishing precision. And if you want to know what all that numerical patterning is about, apart from the fact that it was the ancient Hebrews' idea of a good time, and my idea of a good time too, but some of you may not share those sentiments, the theological point behind that is that through the very messiness of people making bad decisions, God was accomplishing his exact, precise, and perfect plan to reverse the curse and to bring blessing through the seed of Abraham to all of the nations. And that brings us to our first application question. But before we dig into the application, any questions about, I know we went over this sort of quickly. I have a question here in the comment. For the genealogy of Israel, I know there is one woman listed, but is there a significance of why only the men are listed? So you have two women listed included. You have Dinah among Jacob's daughters, and you have Sarah, not Sarah, S-A-R-A-H, but S-E-R-A-H, as one of the grandchildren. So I don't know exactly the possible. So there's been a lot of speculation about it, obviously. So, you know, one reason is enough girls are listed to be able to establish the numerical patterns that the writer is trying to underscore. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is that Dinah, so for Dinah at least, that Dinah is listed because Dinah never married after what happened to her earlier on in the story with Shechem. And so potentially that could also be the reason why Sarah is listed. So maybe those two are listed because they never married. And so they because if they married, they would have been counted with their husbands, whoever it was they ended up marrying. So that's a possibility. And so I don't know. I know only those two women are listed. And so surely there must have been more of them. Nathan Axtell said, sorry if I missed this, but is there any reason specified that Israel's sons were the generation that had no castaways, like you said earlier, no Ishmaels or Esaus? You know, I don't know. There may be something, but I'm not aware of any particular reason that's given other than that's the stage that was arrived in God's plan. So exactly. You know, God had told Abraham that in the fourth generation that they would go down to Egypt, and so that fit what God's plan was. So other than that, the way that God planned it, there may be something that I've missed, but I'm not aware of anything. Anyone else? Anyone written or spoken questions before we do an application question? Three, going once, going twice, going three times. So there may actually be something. I'm just not aware of it. So I've got an application question here. How might we be tempted to think that God is absent when we face confusion and upheaval? And if you were on the ground, this is what we have to realize. If you were on the ground in Jacob's disaster of a family, you would have thought that God was as far removed from what was going on as possible. Even if you believed in God, you would not have been able, in the midst of the messiness, to discern God's providential hand at work. And yet, God was at work in everything that happened. People did what they wanted to do, but God accomplished his purposes through that. And how might we be tempted in our own lives to assume that God is absent when we face confusion and upheaval in our own lives? Anyone? Is someone, Pastor Dave, were you talking?
Ashley has her hand up.
Oh, Ashley, sweetheart.
Okay, can I be heard?
Yep, you can be heard.
Okay, I'm having a few issues with my Wi-Fi, but I just was thinking about sometimes we feel like the Lord's not working and it feels confusing because we're not on his timeline.
That we want him to work on our timeline and we don't necessarily know what his timeline is, but we do know that he has one.
We can't see the big picture. Like looking back in Genesis, it's easy to see him working, but certainly if we were any one of those people, we wouldn't have maybe necessarily felt like he was still keeping his promises.
Yeah, I think that's what we have to see. And that's even what these stories are given to us for, is to see that we can see more, we can see looking back what they could never see looking forward. And that means that those who come after us will be able to see looking back what we can't see looking forward. Elisha Rose messaged, we don't see God's work in the confusion, or we don't see him working the way that we think he should. That's certainly true. Anyone else?
Yeah, I got something. If you think about, like, when we take our kids or our grandkids somewhere, or like on a trip to the zoo or something, we have the whole thing planned out. We know what's going to happen. We know exactly how everything's going to work. And they don't have a clue because they're not at that level of discernment and understanding like we are. We're kind of the same way with God. We're the children of God and we're following, but we really have no way to know exactly what his will is sometimes. And so all we can focus in is our little piece. Where's my cotton candy? Where's my peanuts? Where's my ride on the horsey and stuff like that, rather than the big picture.
Right. And what we've been told about the destination, to fix our eyes on our heavenly home. And actually I'll be preaching on that on Sunday, about how there's what God is offering is so much bigger than what we're looking for, that sometimes we just can't even see where we fit in that map. Sweetheart? Do you have her unmuted, Josh?
I think I'm here now.
Yep, you're here.
It makes me think of the song that I will be singing Sunday. There's a line in it that says, sometimes we want mountains to move and he wants us to climb them.
Yeah, there's a lot of truth to that. Well, anyone else before we move on? Going once, going twice, going three times. Okay, so just one other point. So when you get to Acts 7:14, you have Stephen relating this story And he says, then sent Joseph and called his father Jacob to him and all his kindred. And Stephen mentions a total of 75, or 75 names. And the likely reason for that, so there's been lots and lots of explanation and discussion over the centuries, which I won't bore you with, but the most obvious explanation is that the Greek text of Genesis adds 5 extra names to the genealogy, which brings the total to 75. And the book of Acts is written by someone who, so Luke was clearly more familiar with the Greek text of the Old Testament than the Hebrew text of the Old Testament. And so that's the most obvious explanation. For those that don't like that one, there are several others. But it's not a contradiction. It's just part of the overall transmission of the text down to the day of Christ and down to our own day. And so we talked about the first scene. So in the first scene, we have God appearing to Jacob. In the second scene, we have Jacob's journey down to Egypt. And now in the third scene, we have Joseph meeting Jacob. So verse 28, and he sent Judah before him. So this is Jacob. Jacob sends Judah before him, who's sort of become his representative, and to Joseph to direct his face unto Goshen. And they came into the land of Goshen, and Jacob made ready his chariot and went up to meet Israel, his father, to Goshen, and presented himself unto him, and he fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. And Israel said unto Joseph, now let me die, since I have seen thy face, because thou art yet alive. And Joseph made ready his chariot. So while it's possible that there's a command to a servant that's missed, the distinction is made elsewhere in the story. So elsewhere in the same story, we have Joseph telling his servant to do something, and his servant goes and does it. So it's, you know, possible. So if you go to the story of, say, the crucifixion, it's unlikely that Pilate actually wrote the inscription himself. He probably would have had a scribe do it. But here in the story of Joseph, we find Joseph telling servants to do things and it being recorded that they have done it. And so when it says that Joseph made his chariot ready, our default assumption should be that Joseph did it himself. Now, for the ruler of the land of Egypt to get his own chariot ready was quite extraordinary. He had loads of servants. He could have assigned the job to anyone. And so it seems like the point is that Joseph, in his eagerness to see his father, is doing something that a servant would normally do. Now, who was it who prepared a mode of transportation himself when servants were available earlier in the book of Genesis? We've seen this pattern before. Only it wasn't a chariot, it was a donkey or an ass. Who got up early and saddled a donkey? I see Brother Dave knows, but he's...
Was that Abraham?
Abraham! And Ruth Kinney also did it. Just as you said it on the chat. And Abraham rose up early in the morning and saddled his ass and took two of his young men with him. So Abraham took servants with him, but even though he took servants with him, he saddled the donkey himself. And Isaac, his son, and clave the wood for the burnt offering and rose up and went unto the place of which God had told him. So just a little detail there that shows how earnest and excited Joseph was. And then in verse 30, and Israel said unto Joseph, now let me die, since I have seen thy face, because thou art yet alive. And of course, that reminds us of Simeon, who was an old man who God had promised that he would see the Messiah. And in Luke 2:29, Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace according to thy word. For mine eyes have seen thy salvation, which thou hast prepared before the face of all people, a light to lighten the Gentiles and the glory of thy people Israel. Verse 31. And Joseph said unto his brethren and unto his father's house, I will go up and show Pharaoh and say unto him, my brethren and my father's house, which were in the land of Canaan, are come unto me. And the men are shepherds, for their trade hath been to feed cattle, and they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. And it shall come to pass, when Pharaoh shall call you and shall say, what is your occupation? That ye shall say, thy servant's trade hath been about cattle from our youth, even until now, both we and also our fathers that ye may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination unto the Egyptians. So that phrase, that ye may dwell, is very significant. By drawing attention to their lifestyle, as one writer put it, Joseph hoped that Pharaoh would assign them land on the margin of Egypt, so in a place like Goshen. So Joseph has them wait in Goshen, which was a good place for cattle, and then Joseph tells them, tell Pharaoh that you're shepherds, so that he won't want you. So this whole idea of being an abomination, the idea seems to be that Joseph is concerned that they not intermingle with the Egyptians, but that they be given a place to live by themselves. So that seems to be the point of, because otherwise it's like, why tell Pharaoh that you're shepherds if shepherds are an abomination to the Egyptians? Well, to be truthful, to begin with, but also the reason he's telling them to emphasize this is because he doesn't want them living with the Egyptians, but being given a plot of territory separate from the Egyptians, because he knows that God has a particular purpose for the descendants of Israel. And so scene three is Joseph meeting with Jacob. Any questions or comments up to this point? Anyone? Going once, going twice. All right, moving right along. We've come to scene four, where Joseph's brothers meet Pharaoh. And we've come to chapter 47 in verse 1. Then Joseph came and told Pharaoh and said, my father and my brethren and their flocks and their herds and all that they have are come out of the land of Canaan. And behold, they are in the land of Goshen. And he took some of his brethren, even five men, and presented them unto Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said unto his brethren, what is your occupation? And they said unto Pharaoh, thy servants are shepherds. Now this was actually a question I had been asked about several months ago, long before we got to this section, when we were in it in the Bible reading. And so Joseph had said, you're to say that thy servant's trade hath been about cattle from our youth even until now. But his brothers actually used the term that's translated as shepherds. If that caused any problems with Pharaoh, that's not mentioned. It really seems like the two terms are being used interchangeably, and that Joseph's point wasn't, don't say that you're shepherds. Joseph's point was to emphasize that so that he'll give you a place of land of your own. So that they were an abomination didn't necessarily mean that they, you know, hated them or wanted to destroy all shepherds because they had cattle of their own, but just that they didn't want to live together with people who were shepherds, that it was sort of a caste system, so to speak. And we know from other sources that the Egyptians did a lot of things like that. And so they said unto Pharaoh, thy servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers. They said, moreover unto Pharaoh, for to sojourn in the land are we come, for thy servants have no pasture for their flocks, for the famine is sore in the land of Canaan. Now therefore, we pray thee, let thy servants dwell in the land of Goshen. So it's unclear to what extent this represents a deviation from what Joseph had instructed them to say, but in any account, it has the effect that Joseph hoped it would have. And Pharaoh spake unto Joseph, saying, thy father and thy brethren are come unto thee. The land of Egypt is before thee in the best of the land. Make thy father and thy brethren to dwell. And if thou knowest any man of activity among them, then make them rulers over my cattle. And so remember I told you that this breaks up into basically seven sections, and the central section in all three stories deals with some form of confinement in the land of Egypt. So if you remember, the central section in the first journey to Egypt dealt with Simeon being bound. So all the brothers are bound, and then Simeon's left in prison. In the second story, the second journey, the central section deals with the arrest of all the brothers when the silver cup is found in Benjamin's sack. And it's perhaps not a coincidence that the central scene in this third journey to Egypt deals with the brothers being given permission to remain in Egypt. And it may just be that the patterning of the story itself already hints that the land of Egypt is going to become a place of confinement for them in future generations. So I think we'll stop there in terms of working through the text. I don't think we have time to, well, we can get to the next scene is short. So Jacob meeting Pharaoh, verse 7, and Joseph brought in Jacob, his father, and set him before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh blessed, Jacob blessed Pharaoh, and Pharaoh said unto Jacob, how old art thou? Jacob undoubtedly, at 130 years old, looked very old. And Jacob said unto Pharaoh, the days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have the days of the years of my life been, and have not attained unto the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh. In verse 10, and there's just a quote here that is so striking. Jacob, who in his youth had cheated to obtain a blessing, is now the source of blessing, not just to his family, but to all the families of the earth. So remember how obsessed Jacob had been with getting a blessing? Now Jacob was giving a blessing to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh was a blessing to Jacob. Remember, God said to Abraham, I'll bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. So Pharaoh has given Jacob and his sons land. And we're about to see that in the next section, that he gives them land. And so Joseph turns to be a blessing to Pharaoh by giving to Pharaoh all the land of Egypt. And we'll find that later on in the final, in the next scene, how Joseph cares for his family and cares for Egypt. And Joseph abundantly repays Pharaoh's care for his family. And he does that. That represents really Jacob's blessing, and that Jacob blesses Pharaoh. And through Jacob's descendants, Israel was spared from destruction in the famine. But it's just really striking to see the total transformation of Jacob's life from someone who was a stealer of blessings to someone who was a bestower of them. Any final questions or comments before we wrap up? Anyone? Well, if there's nothing, I don't see any. So, well, let's go before the Lord in prayer and let's conclude. Father, I thank you for this time to explore your word. I just pray, Father, Lord, that you'd help each of us to be faithful to you in all that we do and say and think. Give us the wisdom to know what faithfulness looks like and the strength to pursue it, no matter what the cost. Help us to delight ourselves in your promises. I pray all these things in Christ's precious name. Amen.